Welcome to another episode of Kingdoms Unveiled, where two pastors want to pull back all the clutter that's been put on the Bible concerning its power. The power of God is in the gospel, and at times we clutter it up and we make it humanistic and we try to achieve all of that which we are called to do in faith. We try to do it in the flesh, and because we just don't really believe that there is a spiritual nature to our faith. So that's what we're going to talk about today. What is the supernatural nature of our faith? There is a kingdom of darkness. We're being warned about it multiple times in the New Testament. And we fight back with the strength of the Lord. We tear down strongholds by the truth of Christ. So you have two Reformed Baptist pastors of all, can you believe it, Doug? Crazy Baptists talking about the supernatural. How dare we? We dare because, well, some might call us biblicists. We just call it biblical. Sorry, that was a little snarky there. Good times. If you'd like to learn more about us, Doug is a pastor, been a pastor for over 20 years of the Reformed Baptist Church in Boulder, Colorado. It's the, if you want to know the technical name, it's the Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado. That's because there's not a lot of churches in Northern Colorado. And I'm John Moffitt, the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. And if you'd like to learn more about Doug, I encourage you to do so. He's involved in a lot of great ministries and podcasts. You can go to douglasvandoorn.com, and his books are there and sermons, all that. Myself, I'm at johnmoffitt.com, and I've got several podcasts and ministry that I'm involved in. But something that Doug and I both got put our heads together and spent a lot of time and energy, and we'd love for you to come join us. We put together something called the Reformed Fringe. Doug, tell them about reformedfringe.com.
Come on over to the Fringe, folks. We're having fun. Yeah, it's a chat platform, I guess, that you can live stream. We did our first live stream a week ago on Thursday night.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah, Thursday night.
And so, yeah, we're uploading papers and people talking about all kinds of stuff. And
we have 12 countries represented so far.
Yeah, it's crazy. Who would have ever thought that?
I know.
Coming from everywhere. Coming from
missionaries
out of the woodwork. We got lots of missionaries. We got pastors in there,
professors,
scholars in there, in there. Yep.
And they interact. It's been great.
People are wanting to talk about the fringy stuff of their Bible, the fringy stuff of this world, and do it from the perspective of having Reformed theology as kind of your base.
Yeah. Well, and there are a lot of people in there who aren't Reformed. So
what we say
in the introduction is, Reform friendly, as long as you're not against
hostile
us.
To it, right?
Hostile, thank you. Yeah,
if you're not against me, you're for me.
That's right. And you know, Doug is this way too. A lot of my friends are not Reformed, or they're not Reformed Baptist, and so it's a great place. It's fun. There's at times where it's mostly fringy, and then there are times that there's some. It has way more activity than I ever thought it would have. So if you're looking for a place where you're like, I need to ask questions, I want to be around other people who think this way, they're open-minded.
I feel alone in this world. Yeah. Like, I don't have anybody to talk to about this kind of stuff. You guys are the only people I know that are talking about it. No, there's a whole world out there, and we're trying to hook people up together
so
they can get to meet each other and know each other.
We don't call it a safe space. We call it a haven.
A haven. Which is better than a hoven. A hoven.
Exactly. All right. Doug, I think every topic we talk about is important, but this one's important because it will help you in your Bible reading and preaching. It'll help you in categories of understanding how the supernatural works. Idols are, I think, a mystery to people, you know?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about today is idols, right?
Yeah.
What in the world is an idol?
Well, modern day pastors, you know, I'm guilty of this, Doug. I'll say this. I'm a weak sinner who's growing. But I can remember way back when, you know, when I would preach about idols, it was basically fabricated modern day things like movies or music or my body or, you know, whatever. You could put it in there. But we're always making idols out to be more of like a covetous sin. I mean, there's the sin of idolatry, and then there's the sin of covetousness, yeah. And I don't technically think they're the same thing. Well, I know they're not according to the Bible. So let's start with, Okay, idolatry isn't necessarily things that you make with your mind. They're actually things you make with your hand. So let's start with a definition, Doug. What is technically idolatry according to scripture? And then we'll kind of move into the how it's been used in the Bible and help us understand the supernatural nature of it. So what's a good understanding or kind of like starting point of like, what's the difference between idolatry and covetousness?
You know, I think covetousness encapsulates all the Ten Commandments in one way or another. That's kind of why it's there. It's a summary of them all. So you can break any of those commandments as you covet. So that means that these are, the other nine are specific things, right, that are encompassed in the larger category.
That's good.
For whatever reason, I think a lot of Christians, it's been my experience, have, and this is also ironic, John, because we pride ourselves as Protestants and as Reformed people of splitting up the first two commandments, whereas Rome puts them together and the Lutherans put them together. And yet when it comes down to what's the difference between the first commandment and the second commandment, honest to goodness, there's not much, not much difference, because people, as we've been talking about lately, people don't think that the gods are real. They think that they're idols. And so effectively, you've just eviscerated the first commandment. The second commandment is you shall not make any graven images of anything in heaven above or earth below or under the earth. That's what an idol is. So I actually have a catechism that I put together that I sent to Michael Heiser back when he had just put out was just putting out The Unseen Realm. And I sent it to him hoping that he might just give me a blurb for the thing. And it was a supernatural catechism. He ended up publishing that, and they published it through Lexham as the Unseen Realm Q&A Companion. All right. And so it's a pared down
version. You can buy that on Amazon.
I think you can. I know you can get it on Logos because it was Faith Life that published it.
Well, I bought it from somewhere. I know you can buy it. Go find
it. Yeah, you can get it in a physical copy. And so what, at any rate, the purpose of it was to be a supernatural catechism, right? And so one of the questions I actually had in there was, what is an idol? And the answer that I have in the version I'm looking at here is, forbidden for God's people, idols were thought in ancient times to be the bodies or flesh of the gods, conduits to make the gods and demons do our bidding in exchange for worship or veneration. Now, flesh of the gods is actually the language that they use. You find Augustine using that language as he's talking about somebody named Hermes, giving a definition of what an idol is. So that that was, I mean, flesh of the gods is language that goes back to ancient Egypt. They covered the idols in gold because gold became the flesh of the gods. It was incorruptible. And so another way of putting that would be almost like a house of a god. That's the way that I've come to think of idolatry. And when you understand it that way, my goodness, it takes you in some totally different areas than what you ever would have thought just growing up hearing that if you are a young girl and you go to a mall and you're obsessed with clothes, you're making that your idol. Or if you are a boy and you love football too much, you're making that an idol.
Yeah. And I understand why we try to apply it that way. I mean, obviously those things are dangerous to put anything above God or, I just got done preaching Peter. Peter says, anything that controls you, you are a slave of. So, you know, we want to warn people against being controlled by things of the world, loves of the world, lusts of the world, for sure. But, Doug, when you look at it that way, you know, in most people's minds, when they think of an idol, they're like, oh, somehow the Israelites just fell in. They really got duped by this mysticism of the Egyptians, you know, like somehow they just where, you know, you can see people today where there were like certain kinds of rocks around and there's like superstition. That's, let me put it that way. I think most people think of idolatry as superstition. It doesn't, it's all wives' tale. There's nothing really connected to it.
Yeah.
Right. And that doesn't make any sense because, man, idolatry was one of the commandments that just obliterated Israel constantly. I mean, just they were constantly being warned about their idols, right? Over and over and over again. So there has to be a time where you step back and go, there's more to it than superstition. There has to be more to it than superstition. Well, to see God divide the water and then hold on to an idol doesn't make any sense.
Think of it the way that the prophets compare idolatry to adultery. Like they're two sides of the same coin. Well,
that's right.
How do you commit adultery with something that doesn't exist, isn't real? Now, idols. So what's going on there? And I think this is where some of the confusion comes from, especially with the prophets, right?
Right.
Where they speak as if the gods aren't real. And so we look at an idol and go, well, it's not real. And they actually sometimes compare the God itself to the idol, saying things like, well, it can't even move. It can't smell. It's got a nose, but can't smell. It's got eyes, but can't see. It's got ears, but can't hear. And so we equate the two as if they're the same thing. But that's a polemic that's being used to mock the entities through the practice of idolatry, which was how they actually tried to harness the power of the supernatural entity that they were trying to get to possess the statue or whatever it was that they were using. Mm-hmm. It's a very different sort of a thing.
Yeah. And so I don't want to go heavy into this, Doug, but I'm going to mention it now because you kind of alluded to it. What people don't understand about English translations, what you hold in your hand, most people will probably use that are listening to this show, probably like the ESV, NAS, maybe the New King James. It's the one with the C, the Christian Holman or whatever, Christian Standard Bible, CSB.
Yeah.
Which are all really great translations. But what you don't understand at times is that a translation is also an interpretation. None of those Bibles are what we call a one for one. They don't go exactly from the Hebrew into the English because that's just not how languages work. If you talk to anybody who speaks two languages, they will tell you it's really hard to go from one to one. So therefore, at times you will have English Bibles that they choose a word or they'll choose a phrase or they're like we were laughing about it a couple weeks ago, Doug, when they added the quotes for so-called gods. Remember that in Corinthians?
The scare quotes.
Yeah. The scare quotes. Well, that can happen a lot when you're dealing with idols and gods. An example of this could be even 1 Chronicles 16:26, where it says, for all the gods of the nations are idols. But technically, the translation there could be, like the NET Bible puts it, are worthless. Well, in comparison, because it says, but the Lord made the heavens. So if you're thinking, okay, Israel's God made the world and he sustains it, and then you compare the power of the other gods, it's like, well, why would you ever, it is worth, like, why would you need those gods? They're worthless compared to a comparative statement. But if you have a theology where in your mind, gods are idols and idols are gods, they're synonyms, that's all they are, then that's going to come across in your translations at times. And it's going to be confusing and it's going to be really hard to understand what the writers are saying and what's going on. So the point of our podcast today is to help you process and understand that an idol technically ends up becoming a tool and a mechanism that helps you tap into the power. And this is why a lot of Israel would hold on to these idols because they were, in many ways, they were backups. You know, I love how you said, Doug, the prophets often refer to it as adultery because Israel entered into a covenant with their God, right? So they entered into the covenant and the terms of the covenant were the Ten Commandments. And adultery would then be entering into a covenant with another God. That's why he calls it like they're being unfaithful. They're
unfaithful. That's exactly right. They have a different husband.
Yep. I mean, read Hosea. I mean, that's the whole thing is a story of a picture of their their idolatry in the form of adultery, right? Adultery. So that it's a big deal to God for them to have idols because really holding on to the idol, I've never thought about it this way, Doug, is like Israel holding on to the Ten Commandments, right? Here's kind of our identification of our covenant with you, our God. And when you hold on to the idols, you're holding on to the identification or the source, the access to this other relationship that you're holding on to, this other God. So let's talk a little bit more about, is it just an identification without any consequence? I mean, what why is it so important to them to do this?
There's so much going on here, John, to try and get at this systematically. It might help to do something like this. So If you think about, and I don't want to offend anybody, but I think people need to think about it if they've got this going on in their background. If you think about what Rome does with saint worship, and when you walk into a Roman Catholic church, you'll see all kinds of statues all over the place, right?
Right, yep.
Well, why are they doing that? Well, it's because somehow it's almost like a sacramental union between the saint and the object that looks like it, that is made, you know, that then they'll carry this around with them. They'll wear crosses, they'll, with crucifixes, actually, they'll have a, you know, little, I don't know, trinkets that they carry around that have the kind of embodiment of the saint with them that they can play around with and with their fingers and stuff like that. Well, why do they do that? So Rome will say that they're not worshiping anything, but that they're venerating it. Hmm. Okay. And just stop and think about just that for a minute, because they're venerating what? Something that doesn't exist? No, they're venerating in a saint that they believe will somehow pray to them. They can supplicate it for help. They can give it honor that it's due because of some, you know, the life that they lived in the past, whatever the case may be. And then they do that through the union of that created Christian that died. Mm-hmm. And they do it by uniting that with the physical idol object. Okay. Honest to goodness, when I first started learning about this and I started understanding what the pagans were doing, I said, oh my word, that's literally what Rome is doing with saint worship. It's idol worship. It's the exact same concept. In fact, it wasn't just the gods, but it was actually sometimes a dead family member that they would somehow unite to a figurine. Okay, that they would have in their house, and then that would become the idol that they would do. In fact, that's probably what's going on with the teraphim that Rachel has under her saddle when she takes it out of her dad's house. Those are little idols of dead ancestors that they would pay homage to. So listen to John Calvin talking about this. He says the distinction of what is called dulia and latria was invented, so two Latin terms, invented for the purpose of permitting divine honors or veneration to be paid to angels and dead men with apparent impunity. Latria in Greek has the same meaning as worship in Latin, whereas dulia properly means service, though the words are sometimes used in scripture indiscriminately. So what they're saying is, well, we're venerating, we're honoring them, serving them, but we're not worshiping them. So here's what I find so interesting. We find dulia and the gods together in the Latin Vulgate in many places. So Exodus 23:33, if you serve their gods, these will be an offense to you. Deuteronomy 28:64, you will serve other gods of wood and stone. Like, this is not a good thing to serve them, which Rome is trying to say, no, that's what we're doing. We're not worshiping them. We're serving them. Like, that's not good. And then you get to something like 1 Thessalonians 1:9. It says, you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God. Now, you see what I just did there? I've switched from gods to idols, but both of them are serving. So again, it might make somebody think that, okay, well, they must be the same thing. No. The idol is the house that contains the entity that you end up serving. Mm-hmm. That's the distinction that people have to get through their head, that an idol, so like you can have an idol of Zeus in 100 temples in the ancient Greek world. It doesn't mean you believe there's 100 Zeuses. It means that those are the different houses that have been specially incanted through ritual to be able to allow the entity to somehow come into it. In fact, I have a quote about how they did this. Check this out. This comes from a scholar, last name of Robbins. And he goes, when a non-physical being manifested in a statue, this anchored the being in a controlled location where living human beings could interact with it through ritual performance. In order for human beings to interact with deities and to persuade them to create, renew, and maintain the universe, these beings had to be brought down to Earth. This interaction had to be strictly controlled in order to avoid both the potential dangers of unrestricted divine power and the pollution of the divine by impurity of the human world, while the ability of deities to act in visible human realm was brought about through their manifestation in a physical body. Manifestation in one body did not in any sense restrict deity, for the non-corporeal existence of a deity was unlimited by time and space and could manifest in all its bodies, in all locations, all at one time, through the statue. I'm going to give you one other quote before we keep talking about this. This is from John Frame, and this is actually in his Doctrine of the Christian Life. He says, in paganism, the relationship between the image and the god is more than merely pictorial or even representative. Something of the sanctity of the god attaches to the image itself. In other kinds of paganism, the relation between the image and the god may be thought of as a sacramental conduit of divine influence, or as a representation of the divine, in which case the image deserves reverence because of what it represents. Mm. Remember the golden calf incident, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is really important for people to get their heads wrapped around. When Israel is in the wilderness and they're at the foot of Mount Sinai and they see at least the repercussions of God being on top of the mountain, because they see the smoke and the lightning and the thunder and they're terrified down at the bottom. So right. What do they say after Moses is gone after a few days? They're like, Aaron needed to make us a calf so that we can somehow worship God. And what does Aaron say? He doesn't say, okay, well, we're going to give up this god because he's obviously not real. So we're going to go to some of the old gods of Egypt and I'm going to make a calf and it'll represent them. Which, of course, as everybody says, they're not real either. No, he says tomorrow will be a feast to Yahweh. And then out comes the calf, which represents Yahweh. So what's the point of the statue, John? The statue is that god that's up there on that mountain, we can't control him. He terrifies us. We want to die when he's around us. If he speak to him, Moses, because if he speaks to us without a mediator, we're all dead. That's what they say at the very end of the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. So they're like, no, let's make this golden calf. And that way, what we can do through incantation or whatever is we can harness that power and we can make it do our bidding and we can give it the worship, you know, him, the worship that he deserves through the image, and the image will mediate for us instead of Moses doing the mediation. It's a way to control the deity. That's what idolatry is.
I mean, I'm thinking right now, there are multiple verses where it says, who is God that he could be in a house or be put into a house? You know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. What is the house that you would build for me? All these other gods have their house. What's in the pagan temples? That's statues right. of the deities. Because the those are the idols, because that's its house.
Yeah, and it's transactional in nature. You do something for the god, and then you get the benefits of the power of the gods.
Absolutely. And this is why they would have to perform sex magic. This is why they would have to do blood sacrifices, human sacrifices, whatever that particular deity was into, the people would do it. And then the power would come somehow through that ritual and they would be able to participate in it.
Yeah, for sure. And what's interesting is that, you know, I was reading, I forget who I was reading, it doesn't really matter, but they were talking about the plagues and how the magicians somehow used trickery to match Moses's power of Yahweh. And I found it interesting that they wouldn't say gods work was trickery. Moses wasn't right. using trickery.
Yeah. But, they're but just they were clever using... magicians that went yeah. on Penn and Teller and fooled the crowd. That's right. the way people think about it.
So just to help you guys out a little bit, like Beelzebub, we did this a couple of weeks ago where the king of Moab makes a sacrifice of his son, and then wrath comes upon Israel and Israel leaves Egypt. Go to the story of Job. I mean, Job is underneath definitely the wrath of the accuser, and his family dies. He gets boiled. So to say that, oh, and by the way, Satan is not the only fallen angel. We don't even know how many they are. And that's not even a question. Okay. So if Satan has power, he's a fallen angel. It's safe to say that there is, and all the Old Testament, Doug, does not have a problem naming names of these other gods, like female and male names. And what Israel had was representation of these gods. This is why the prophets would know what gods they were dealing with, because you went into that land, you took their gods. Mm-hmm. I see the idols in your tent. I can see them. We need to gather them and burn them. But this is going back to the law. And again, all that we want you to understand is that the Bible is full of these warnings because they're real. This is Deuteronomy 18:10. Just listen for a moment, okay? There shall not be found among you any who burns his son or his daughter as an offering. Now that is just nuts on our mind, Doug.
Yeah.
Right? But in a pagan mind, this becomes a potential necessary practice because, well, the king of Moab did it because he thought the whole kingdom was about to be destroyed. And so he made one of the most ultimate sacrifices and was like, look, I just lost another 700 men. It's time to get this thing over with. Time to kill the sun, right? I'm going to get the attention of the God to come down to me. But he's not done. Listen, anyone who practices divinations or tells fortunes or interprets omens or a sorcerer or a charmer or a medium or a necromancer or one who inquires of the dead. Remember, we were talking about how there was this connection with the dead in the Roman Catholic Church. By the way, I was thinking about that Disney cartoon Coco, Day of the Dead. Just thought I'd throw that out there. Whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord. Whoa. I mean, that is all I know is I don't ever want to be identified as an abomination to the Lord ever, whatsoever. It, guys, can you just stop and think for a moment. He gives you these list of things and says, if this is what you're doing, it's not like, please stop. It's an offense. He's like, this is an abomination. I don't know, Doug, can you get anything worse than abomination? I think that's like the strongest definition of this is bad. This is really bad. Right? So I always kind of chuckle when we look at the sin of idolatry and what it's connected to. Like, these are the things that are connected to idolatry. This is what they're doing to gain the power of these idols. And the prophets are saying multiple times, guys, this is like the worst thing you can do. That we should pay attention to that.
Maybe it might be helpful to go through some of the, especially Hebrew words that are used mm-hmm. in idol passages. Mm-hmm. The most central one would be a word pesel. This is the word a graven image. This is what the mm-hmm. second commandment forbids. It forbids the making of pesels, a graven image. That speaks for itself as to what it is. However, there's all kinds of other words that are used in conjunction with idols that mm-hmm. might help people understand that there's more going on here than just some dude, you know, carving some image and then somehow like worshiping nothingness. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a word in Hebel. This is the word that you find over and over in Ecclesiastes. Vanity, vanity, all is mm-hmm. vanity. Hebel. The word itself is onomatopoetic, where it like it's vain itself. It's just fleeting. Hebel, like the air, you know. It means empty or vain. That's a word that's used that we translate as idol. But the word means empty or vain. It doesn't mean non-existent. Synonym, another one is elilim, which can mean weak or feeble. Another one is Mishlet Set, which means a thing of horror or a thing of shuddering. You have the word Gilulim, which means dung. Now, you just brought up the word abomination. The abominations of the nations are gods like Milcom and Ashtra and Ashtoreth and Chemosh and Molech. But the word Gilulim is used at the very same time, which says that these abominations are dung. They are rubbish. A good one here is the way that people translate Psalm 96:5.
Yeah.
We've talked about this in the, you know, kind of off air several times.
Right.
I think the ESV translates, "For all the gods of the peoples are idols." And so people will go, "Oh, see, they're the same thing." But the problem is that the word there is Elelim. Technically, it should read, "All the gods of the nations are worthless." In fact, if you go to the Greek, you will see that it translates it, "All the gods of the heathens are devils, demonia." Now all of a sudden we've moved from non-existent to demons. And the Latin uses the very same word. And I love the word that Wycliffe chose in 1388 in Middle English. "For all the goodness of the heathen, men being fiendish." And what is that? That is a fiend. They're fiends. They're demons. Right. They're worthless. They're vanity. Those are the kinds of words that you need to think about, what's being represented by the idol. And so, of course, for a prophet, as he's mocking these worthless, feeble, weak, dung, things of horror, things of shuddering that are behind the idol, what better way to do it, John, than to use the actual idol thing itself and go, "See, they can't even move. They can't do anything." One of my favorite stories is when the Ark of the Covenant is taken into the into the Philistine territory,
so
it goes before Dagon in his temple, then they come back and they're like, Dagon has fallen on his face as if he has to worship the Lord. It's a great story, and it's not like just an accidental falling of the no. It's a pictorial representation through the idol that Dagon has no power over Yahweh. Yahweh, who can't be represented by an image. And by the way, why can't Yahweh be represented by an image? Because he gives his own image of who
he is.
That's right. And that image is not a piece of wood or a piece of stone. It's the living embodiment of who he is in the person of Christ.
Doug, why you always got to bring it back to Jesus? Like, what's up with that?
I know. I don't know.
Hey.
Go ahead.
No, that's fine.
I was going to be snarky, so go ahead.
It's okay. This podcast can handle it. No, I think it's interesting is that Paul even makes this connection. I don't know if you were going to go here, but Paul talks about when they make sacrifices to idols. What does he say? You're making... No. Hold on. Let me correct that. He says you're fellowshipping with demons.
With demons. Yeah, 1 Corinthians, do not be idolaters, 1 Corinthians 10:7. But then 10:19, what do I mean? That an idol is anything? So he's giving you the impression that an idol isn't anything. But then one verse later, he says, but I just want you to remember that what pagans sacrifice to, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. I don't want you to have fellowship with demons. And put that in the context of the Lord's Supper.
It's right. Because when we partake of the Lord's Supper, we have this participation. That's how Paul describes it.
It's koinonia. It's communion. Fellowship. That's literally what it is.
So he's saying you cannot commune with God in the spirit realm, in the spirit within your soul, and be communing with demons. So when you say, making an idol out of football, that's not what they had in mind. What they had in mind was, you are literally on purpose attempting to commune, have partnership, receive. Listen, why do we take communion, Doug? We want the benefits of God. Like, we want those benefits towards us. Then why were they making sacrifices to idols? They wanted the benefits of the demons. They wanted the benefits of the power of the gods. And they could get those powers because they existed. And that's the thing that if we are trying to convince you of anything, is that idolatry isn't just the worship, the madness of thinking that you have superstitious result. You know, like, I won't be in a car accident today. You know, it's almost like a lot of what the Catholics do with the certain necklaces that they wear with the charms of like this saint and that saint. Like, this is the saint of like, you know, whatever. I won't be in a car accident today if I wear this omen. That is not what's happening. Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is actually the ancient world with their demons, that's exactly what they were doing too, though. Like, they would like protect me, give, you know, they would do an enchantment, they'd do an incantation, and then they would have their little idol, and the idol would be a protecting sort of a deity. That's what I'm saying is that it's not a good thing what Rome did in in making saint veneration in the exact same practice as what the pagans did with idols. In fact, I don't know if you know this, but and I'm not trying to justify what the Orthodox do, but prior to the big split in what was it, the 11th century between the East and West and the church, there was 200 years of fighting over iconoclasm. And what in the world should the church do? And they actually held councils to talk about this, because what the East saw was that the West was creating actual physical three-dimensional statues, and they very strongly believed that that was forbidden by all the Old Testament. And they're like, all we're doing is painting on a wall the picture of the saint, and you don't get the same in their mind. People can do their own study on this or not if they think that it's right or wrong, but in their mind, you can't get an entity to somehow enter into the house of an icon that's painted on a wall, but you most certainly can do it in a statue. And that was this was one of the two main things that led to the split of the church, the other thing being the papacy.
That's right. So I mentioned this to you earlier, Doug, and we can shift and talk about this now. One of the things, if you pay close attention, those who are loyal to Yahweh, his angels, his principalities, they are quick to keep anyone from worshiping them. Don't worship me. We are here to worship the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. But those who have rebelled, what was one of the temptations? I will give you the world. I will give you Rome. I will give you the kingdoms. I will give you everything that I have authority over. Worship me. The gods want to be worshiped like Yahweh. They want to feel that significance. And so you'll see them, they constantly mimic Yahweh. They create for themselves a house. They demonstrate their power and they want praise. So all of these Israelites, these millions of Israelites that come out of Egypt and they're holding on to these idols, you mean to tell me that the God that represents those idols isn't feeling significant? It's like, look how many of them have my idol. Like, look at how many of them have my house. Like, there is a significance to that. And it's interesting where God will come in and mock them and obliterate them and utterly destroy them. So I'll give you an example. He pulls them out of Egypt. This is Deuteronomy. Make sure I get the I forgot the section where I have right here. Okay. So this is Numbers, sorry, not Deuteronomy. This is Numbers 33, and it's reflecting on what happened during the Exodus. And it says, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord God had struck down among them. So this is God's judgment upon the humans. Then it says, on their gods also the Lord executed judgment. Nowhere in the Bible ever do you see God executing judgment on idols. It's important for you to understand that. He executed judgment on beings who had not only falsely taken the worship of Egypt, but also had taken the worship of the Israelites, and God executed judgment on them for it and said, you will punished for this. Now, what he did, I don't know. I mean, is this Psalm 82? I don't know. I mean, we don't know. We don't know what the execution of the judgment is there, but it's mentioned twice in Exodus 12, 2 or 12:12, it mentions the same thing, that he executes judgment on them.
Yeah, so the judgment on the gods there is the Ten Commandments, or the Ten Plagues.
Right. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Right, so each of those plagues corresponds to one of the different deities of Egypt. And what God is doing is he's showing himself to be powerful over the god of the river, over the god of pestilence, over the god of the firstborn, all those kind of, you know, death. Mot, I think, is the god of death in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And the point is, like, think about this. If God is showing himself to be superior to entities that don't exist, what is the point? But he's showing himself powerful over the gods, and he judges the gods as he does it. And like you said, you can destroy an idol. That happens all the time in the Old Testament.
Sure.
But you don't judge an idol.
It can't judge an idol. It would
be like walking up to my front door and say, I judge you, house. Maybe the Amityville Horror House. That's like the only one you could do. But guess what? That's because it's possessed by demons.
That's right. Yeah, Psalm 97:7. This is where hopefully these verses will start having more of a full picture for you. All worshipers of images are put to shame who make their boast in worthless idols. Now, Doug, why would they boast in a worthless idol? Because that's where you think your power is, right? That's where the power is. Like, I'm holding on to this idol because it's a representation of the power. And it's like, you should be put to shame for that. And what's interesting, at the bottom of that verse, it says, worship him, worship Yahweh, all you gods. So what's interesting is, it's a beautiful picture. The gods to whom they're worshiping, the writer of the psalm says, those gods worship Yahweh. Like, the gods you're worshiping, they're the ones who are supposed to be worshiping the God of the universe, the God of gods, the Almighty. And it's, once you understand that, it's not like, because how do you make idols worship? That doesn't make any sense, because they don't worship. The representations of the idols do, the gods do. And so this is a really healthy and helpful way, especially in the Psalms. It comes up a lot. And then, but so Doug, how do we then, this is the last question, because this is the question that most people get. How do we interpret these passages where the prophets, well, they seem to call the gods idols, and they say they're worthless, and they mock them. Like, where is he? Is he relieving himself? Is he taking a nap? Like, how do we interpret these passages from the prophets that seem to come up not just one or two times, but quite a few times?
Well, and the one you just mentioned, that's Baal. In that case, there's actually no statue there. He's actually mocking the god himself, because this is the storm god. That's what Baal is, and he's on top of the mountain, and he's supposed to be able to create lightning and fire. Mm-hmm. That's what he does. And here we have the dousing of the, you know, all the trenches or whatever, putting water in them, and then the Lord hasn't done anything yet. He's just calling out, oh, you got 400 prophets of Baal. Certainly one of you should be able to do something. And they start cutting themselves and doing all these crazy rituals, and nothing happens. And so the whole point of that story is that this is a fight between Yahweh and Baal. And how has Baal shown up to this fight? He hasn't shown up at all. It doesn't mean he doesn't exist. It means that when you look at the story, who is the one who comes through? It's Yahweh. He's the one who makes the fire, and then all the Baals end up being consumed, and they put them all to death and all this kind of stuff, because they're worshiping a false god, not in the sense that it doesn't exist, but in the sense that it's a liar. When we say somebody is false, we don't say you're known exist.
They don't exist.
Yeah. We say that you're a liar. This is the language that Tolkien uses in The Lord of the Rings with Gollum. He's false. He's treacherous, right? So we need to be thinking about the other uses of words than what has come into the modern vernacular as we think about something like false, as we think about worthless. And, it also helps to go back and just know what the Hebrew word or the Greek word is that you're looking at. Can be very helpful, as we've pointed out already. So, it's a mockery. The prophets are mocking the gods.
So we know that there's communication amongst the spirit realm, and they travel and that kind of thing. Can you imagine, like, hey, Baal, you got called out, man. Who called me out? Well, the prophet of Yahweh. Oh, I'm not going for that. I'm not going. You know? So he's like, hey, where is he? Why isn't he here? It's like, he's not showing up because he knows who his opponent is. And there's no way he's going to win. Daniel 4:35. One of my absolute favorite verses in the Bible. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And he does according to his will among the host of heaven.
Right.
And among the inhabitants of the earth.
Isn't it wild how often, John, that they actually say the host of heaven or the heavenly things and the earthly things? Why do they do that if there's nothing up there to worry about?
That's right. Well, then Paul does the same thing in Romans. You know, he's like, look, don't worry about it. Nothing can separate you from the love of God because there's nothing more powerful than God. We don't believe that there's, you know, the power of Satan and God's really worried about him. I think what's interesting about that particular story, and it's interesting, Doug, where we forget Job, you know, we forget that story. We forget the story with Jesus on the mountain with Satan and he offers him all these powers. And then yet we look at the prophet and say, see, it doesn't exist. It's like, well, they do exist. The point of it being is that there's nobody going to show up to fight God or Yahweh. It's not going to happen. I mean, that you know that there was a host of spiritual beings all sitting around going, oh man, this is really sad. We're really getting made fun of now. And all the ones who are showing allegiance to Jesus, they're like, this is awesome. They should be mocked. They should be made fun of, those rebels. You know, in my mind, because you know, like Paul talks about, they look into it and they watch and there's this intrigue about what's happening. That's what's going on. It's not, oh man, this is a really hard passage to interpret. I guess the gods don't exist. There's no God that was going to show up. Not one was going to show up to fight him. It's just not going to happen. So anyways, good times. Here's it.
Let me give you just kind of a little, I don't know, we could do this for a whole show on its own, but it's interesting to me. I've given some thought to what they made their idols out of. And this kind of gets back to the idea of painting versus statues. Mm-hmm. So in the scripture, it's always two mediums. It's either wood or stone. Mm-hmm. That's it. And in fact, the Canaanites talk about the whisper of tree and the whisper of stone. Mm-hmm. Like, what is going on there? So just a couple things to think about. First of all, is that the words for trees start with L, which is exactly what God starts with. His name is either El or Elohim or Elyon. You have this really wild place in Exodus 15, where the Israelites camp right before they go in to be tested, which is really curious, at Elim. Elim means gods, but there's a play on word there, wordplay on Elim, because they're there around 70 palm trees and 12 springs of water. Well, 70 is the number of the divine council, and it's palm trees. Why? Because this becomes the launching place of the temptation. They're like sitting there right in the midst of the divine council of gods at Elim, about ready to go into the wilderness of Sin, where the whole manna story will come. And will they believe God or will they not? Will they test God? Right. What's going to happen? And it's a mockery, and it's using trees to do it. And somehow, in my mind, there is a link between, I don't know what it is, but there's a link between the medium of the trees and stones and what the gods are. And just to kind of confirm that, I want you to think about God himself. Jacob calls him the stone of Israel. Moses calls him the rock. Daniel calls him, in Daniel 4, he says he sees a giant mountain that comes as it's rolling down this hill, more rock stuff, the rock of ages. This is what Jesus is. Secondly, think about tree stuff with God. I think Amos calls him like a pine tree. And Jesus is the branch of Jesse, the shoot that comes up out of the remnant, all this kind of stuff. Why? Because somehow there's some kind of a weird link going on. The pagans understood that, and they were using those mediums to help contain the gods, but God is uncontainable, and so you can't control him. You can't put him in any kind of a statue. And like we said earlier, which I think is the best way to cap off the any discussion with idols and images, is that Jesus is the image of the one true God. He gives us the image of himself. We don't go looking for images to try and figure out how to contain him or emulate him or anything like that.
Do you think Tolkien and Lewis picked up on this? Because you remember, it's like I think it's in C.S. Lewis, and he says some of the trees are loyal to the White Witch.
Yeah, I don't have it. They would have understood this.
Yeah. Well, then, yeah, that's interesting. Just thought I'd throw that out there. That's fascinating. Well, hopefully this is helpful. It's a starter conversation. We're hoping to build and keep growing and keep expanding. And ultimately, we want you, and I love how Doug did this at the end, we just want you to be more and more intrigued with Jesus Christ. Like that's all of idolatry, adultery, all of this, sorcery. It's all to pull our hearts and our minds away from the true power. Listen, once you understand how powerful God is, what does Paul say? The gospel is the power of God. Like, we don't need idols. We don't need the ways of the world. You can have the power source of the loving and all gracious and powerful God in the person of Jesus Christ, in the good news of who he is.
And for people trapped in idolatry, John, like real idolatry, and there's real people that are in cultures around us. Maybe somebody will, we got to bring them to listen to this episode. I don't know. Understand that the power of the one who provides his own image is not just on a scale of power compared to these other entities. It's incomparable because he is the eternal, uncreated, all sovereign, all knowing God of the universe who control, like the verse you just said with Nebuchadnezzar, no one can hold back his hand or say to him, what have you done? No one in heaven, no one on earth. And fleeing to the arms of Jesus himself, who is God in the human flesh. And if you've seen him, you've seen the Father. It's an incomparable power. And he has infinite power over anything that anybody has ever been trapped in with regards to these evil, dark, pagan practices.
The people creator
need to know that.
That's right. The creator, sustainer, and judge of the world. No one can have that title but one. So don't really want to worship any other gods, especially when he tells you not to. Probably want to pay attention to that. So what a fun discussion. We always post the episodes when they launch inside the Fringe so we can talk about them, which I completely forgot to do that. So I need to do that today. Anyways, come and join us. We'd love to have your conversations in the Reformed Fringe. And we'll pick this conversation back up. We're just kind of doing the basics right now. So you can go back and listen. We did the basics on the gods, on the divine council. We're working on idols. We'll do some stuff on demons and angels. We're just going to keep kind of work through and help people kind of add another crayon to their box so that the more colors of their Bible start to come to life and you can worship Jesus Christ in greater, more and more wonderful ways.
So instead of having like that crayon box where you're a little kid and it's like eight colors, your mom buys she goes all out and gets you the 64 color crayon box.
64.
And the kid who had that was like the coolest kid in the world.
That's right. Can I have the 9 different colors of yellow, please? All right. Thank you for listening and God hopefully encourages you. And if you're not a part of a good church, please go do so, because what Doug and I truly believe that the power of God is in the preaching of the gospel. So go hear the gospel preached this weekend. God bless you.